the significant involvement of Israel in the Sri Lankan civil war has not evoked any inquiry from global human rights organizations till today.
Evidence suggests that the Sri Lankan war that lasted for 26 years, killing thousands of people, was assisted by foreign elements. Peace and conflict analysts say that the UN and the Western countries that claim to be the guards of world human rights have maintained a complete silence on Israel's role in the Sri Lankan civil war, probably trying to mask the wrongdoings of the Zionist regime and safeguarding their personal military and economic interests. According to Israeli human rights activists, there is more than enough evidence to justify opening a criminal investigation into the involvement of Israeli companies, officials and private individuals in the crimes committed in Sri Lanka. However, keeping in view the past experience, experts say there is feeble chance of any legal action against the regime. Conflict analysts maintain that the failure of the world human rights organizations to seek accountability from the Zionist regime for its crimes against humanity has sent signals that atrocities against innocent people can be continued with impunity. It is important to mention that in recent years, Israel has also supplied arms to the military junta in Myanmar, accused of ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya Muslims. According to foreign affairs experts, Israel has become a weapon supplier to dubious regimes in the world, thus threatening world peace.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Dr. Ponsara Amarasinghe from Colombo, who is a researcher at St. Anna's School for Advanced Studies. First of all, welcome to the program, Dr. Amarasinghe.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're more than welcome. Now, sir, for all these years, either the government or the LTTE have been blamed for the war crimes in Sri Lanka. So the question is, why has there been a global silence over the role?
Well, you have raised two questions in one, so let me ask them categorically from one by one. And firstly, when it comes to those so-called war atrocities or war crimes committed in Sri Lanka, which seems to be an attempt made by the international community, especially by the Western media propagandas and the Western countries, to tarnish the image of Sri Lanka. Because in reality, realistically, the civil war that took place in Sri Lanka for past 30 years was not a war between the government and the Tamil community, which was rather than a military conflict between a separatist group called LTTE, the Tamil Eelam terrorist group, and the government of Sri Lanka, and specifically this the Eelam group, the LTTE, started the war firstly by not killing the people from the majority, but they started the war by killing the Tamils. And regarding the question that you ask about the global silence over the role of Israel in Sri Lanka, the answer is rather simple, because there have not been open evidence or there have not been much something realistically on the ground regarding the Israelis' role in the country. But in truth, if you look at the statistical information on how Israeli interfered with Sri Lankan military conflict that dates back to the 1980s, firstly, let me tell you that Israel provided arms and weapons to the government armies of Sri Lanka in various ways. Firstly, it started to train the Sri Lankan armed forces in the 80s. And secondly, it was assisted by the U.S. Embassy in Colombo to start their own research bureau, the embassy section in Colombo, and which dealt with a lot of government affairs within Sri Lanka. But unfortunately, neither Israel nor the government of Sri Lanka have openly affirmed about this role of Lavim in Colombo.
So, Dr. Amarasinghe, we know about the involvement of Israel in Sri Lanka. So how did Israel get involved and why Sri Lanka?
Yeah, that's a very pertinent question. I think, as I told you in my analysis, that firstly, the Israel Research Bureau was started in 1984, just 1 year after the commencement of the military conflict of Sri Lanka. And initially, the Israelis started training the armed personalities from Sri Lankan army and navy air forces in Israeli bases. But simultaneously, they were doing something rather dodgy. Because while training the Sri Lankan army officers, from one side, they provided the armed training for the guerrillas came from Sri Lanka as well, especially if you read Victor Strosky's By the Way of Deception, the famous the book on the Mossad involvement in South Asia and Eastern Asian campaigns. Strosky has clearly acknowledged that Israeli armed forces were providing armed training for both Sri Lankan government and also the LTTE guerrillas simultaneously. I mean, that was something really funny from one side. And I would say that after that, throughout the 90s till the arrival of Mahinda Rajapaksa in 2005 to the power, the Israeli government kept providing Kafir jets and also Dora, the equipments, and also the Gabriel C missiles for the Sri Lankan armed forces. And I must say that I must acknowledge that those were not the donations, by the way. There was a tremendous amount of the trade agreement, the armed trade deals between Israel and Colombo government. And because from one side in the 90s, most of the Western countries stopped providing us the arms and ammunition, so Sri Lankan government had no other options except looking for other alternatives, in particular from Israel, because Israel seemed to be a pretty interesting armed trade weapon for the government of Sri Lanka, who did not ask for any of those human rights violations or human rights conditions. So that was pretty simple.
Now, Dr. Amarasinghe, why is there a silence over Israel's dangerous arms sales? The UN and Western countries that claim to be the defenders of human rights in the world have preferred silence over Israel's involvement. Why?
I mean, that's highly, I would say, that ironic situation. You can't simply call Western countries as the defenders of human rights if you have realistically looked at the atrocities committed by Americans and the British in places like Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. So I would say that it would be a biggest blunder to call them the defenders of human rights. But when it comes to Sri Lankan issues, the Western countries have taken specific stances in human rights alleged violations by the Sri Lankan military forces during the civil war, specifically due to the fact that Sri Lankan government mainly relied on countries such as China, Pakistan, and especially the Russian Federation. Especially, I need to tell you that after 2005, after Mahinda Rajapaksa came to power, Israelis completely stopped selling their armed equipments and the other ammunition for Sri Lankan government, because they feared that Mahinda Rajapaksa's alliance, the closer rapport with countries like Iran and China and Russian Federation, might undermine them in the long run. So basically, the Sri Lankan armed forces fundamentally relied on the military aid came from countries like China and Russia. So at the end of the war, the Western countries have made a tremendous hullabaloo over those issues, especially regarding how China and Russia provided arms and ammunition for Sri Lankan government forces, but they did not talk about the role played by Israelis in the 1980s, because we need to understand, we need to acknowledge, it was Israeli forces, firstly, who helped us to establish the special task force, which is called the STF in Sri Lanka, which is something equivalent to Israeli Shin Bet force. So that was actually carried under the Israeli assistance. But since that Israel seems to be a country which has been favored by Washington, the Western countries are reluctant to talk about the Israelis' role in Sri Lankan civil affairs, which actually, you know, lies underneath. But on the contrary, they keep criticizing and they keep talking about the contribution made by countries like China, Pakistan, and Russian Federation. I would simply say it's rather hypocritical.
That's right, sir. Before we let you go, sir, some human rights activists have said that there's enough evidence to support criminal investigation against the Zionist regime, okay? So do you think Israel will be held accountable for its crimes or for what it's done?
I think that if you look at the current political order, whatever the resolution raised in the United Nations can be vetoed by the permanent member states to the United Nations Security Council. So in that case, whatever the resolution comes before the UN always would be automatically vetoed by the US or one of the aligned countries to Israel. So I think it is highly unlikely to think about any kind of a criminal investigation against Israel under the current geopolitical scenario. I mean, I know it seems to be pretty unfortunate scenario, but that has been the reality of the global power political regime which you and I are undergoing.
That's right, sir. Thank you, Dr. Amarasinghe, for being on the program, sir.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome. On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Punsara Amarasinghe from Colombo. He's a researcher at St. Anna School for Advanced Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Vindhya Budhpitiya, an anthropologist working on conflict and visual culture, tweeted, Israeli complicity in Sri Lanka war crimes must be investigated. During the civil war, Israel sold weapons and backed the Sri Lankan army while it was committing grave atrocities. Dr. Mamoon, a science enthusiast, tweeted, Imagine Israel participated in Sri Lanka's government's brutal war against civilians in the civil war. Zionists are thirsty for blood creatures. Parthiban Shanmuganathan, a journalist and media trainer, tweeted, Israel is one of them. In the 2000s, Sri Lanka became one of Israel's most important countries in Asia, undertaking significant procurement of Israeli military technology. Israelis also trained Sri Lankan troops involved in the war. We the People, a Pakistani interested in political, social and economic issues, tweeted, Israel is an outpost of US in the Middle East to intimidate its neighbors for the sake of increasing the sale of arms industry. Western global politics has now been rallied around creating conflicts and war zones. Ukraine is the latest example.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
On July 14, 2023, the Indian Space Research Organization launched Chandrayaan 3, the country's latest endeavor in lunar exploration. Building upon the success of its predecessors, Chandrayaan 1 and 2, this mission aims to achieve a controlled landing on the moon, providing an example of India's commitment towards advancing its presence in the global space community. The mission holds immense geopolitical significance for India, as its success could have far-reaching implications not only for India's space program, but also on regional dynamics.
The launch of the spacecraft marks a pivotal moment in India's space exploration journey. The Chandrayaan 3 mission aims to demonstrate a safe and soft landing on the moon, control rover operations and perform on-site experiments on the lunar surface.
India's space exploration sector has been, it's a miracle, it's a success story, it's one of a kind in the third world. Normally, if you look at the countries who have achieved, milestones as far as space exploration is concerned, you will find the countries either are from the first world or the second world. By second world, I mean Soviet Union and the allied countries. But if you look at India, India has achieved a lot under the constraints. And one of the areas where we can be considered among the top countries in the world is the area of space exploration. Economically also, it gives India a lot of benefit, because India then launches the satellite other countries in space, and it brings in foreign exchange to India, which is a big achievement for a country like India. As far as Chandra campaign is concerned, it was a very ambitious campaign, and we failed once, but we have worked on that, and I believe in years to come, India will be seen as the peer power in terms of peer power when it comes to space and space explorations and related areas.
If successful, this mission will buy India access to an exclusive club that includes the United States, Russia and China as one of the few nations to achieve a controlled landing on the moon, elevating India's standing in the global space race.
As I said, this gives India's space image a big boost. Why I say a big boost is that already a lot of countries are using India's rockets to have their satellite placed in the orbit. And whether it is a weather satellite or it is a GPS-based satellite. This success will mean that our rockets are powerful enough to go beyond the area where we are operating now, which means that more and more countries will come and hire our rockets for placing their satellites in the orbit of in the orbits. This is a big achievement in terms of exploration but also in terms of financial gains. So it is something that India is very proud of, and I hope and believe that this is one of the organizations in India which runs like a first world organization, and I believe that in years to come it will achieve further.
The Chandrayaan lander that weighs 1500 kg carries a 26 kg rover in its belly. In a hope to find something new, the rover will focus on the physical characteristics of the surface of the moon, the atmosphere close to the surface, and the tectonic activity below the surface. The South Pole region of the moon, where the spacecraft aims to land, holds the promise of valuable resources, including frozen water, that could play a crucial role for future space missions.
It is vital because if you look at moon, the thing with moon is that it's a spin on its axis in 27.5 days. But it also takes moves around the axis of Earth in 27.5 days, which means that if you are at one place in the world, you will only see one face of moon at any given time, because the spinning time is equal to the revolution time is equal to rotation time. Which means that the other side of the moon, which we say the dark side of the moon, has not been that well explored. What India is trying to achieve is that to explore the unexplored area, which is the dark side of the moon. Very few countries have managed to explore about it. US and China are probably only two countries which have explored some of the areas on the darker side. So dark side of the moon is an area which is largely unexplored, and India wants to explore that aspect of moon. It will have a great scientific benefit, not only for India, but also for the entire scientific world.
India's successful landing in this region can attract attention from other space organizations and private space companies seeking to tap into the potential resources. According to Indian space scientists, the ultimate goal for India's probes is to find a possibility for Moon to become an extended continent of the Earth.
In the world arena, in the years to come.
With its remarkable achievements in low-cost Asia, India's space agency has long been a source of pride for the South Asian country. However, the Ukraine conflict and the subsequent sanctions imposed on Russia by the United States have cast a shadow over India's space endeavors. While the conflict has primarily affected Ukraine and Russia, its geopolitical ripples extend beyond the borders. Strategic relations experts say India, a traditional partner of Russia in the realm of space cooperation, will also have to bear the brunt of these sanctions.
Traditionally, space cooperation has remained immune to geopolitical tensions. However, the war in Ukraine has introduced a new dynamic. Through the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the United States has been trying to isolate Russia from its allies. Over the years, India has enjoyed a fruitful partnership with Russia, collaborating in various domains, including space flight, satellite navigation, launch vehicle development, and planetary exploration. Foreign relations experts say escalating sanctions could hinder India's importation of space-related equipment from Russia.
See, as of now, there is very little or no impact. It is because, the space program of Russia vis-a-vis its collaboration with India has not been sanctioned. That part has been kept out of sanction because the deals were struck with Russia and India pre-Ukraine war deals. Those have been kept out of any kind of sanctions. First thing. Second, India understands its strategic ledge over US, where it knows that US needs India for the containment of China. And because US needs India for the containment of China, it gives India some breathing space where it can, in a limited way, dictate some of the policies. And one of these is that beyond a point, India will not follow the unilateral sanctions posed US and EU, because these are not UN sanctions, these are unilateral sanctions. So, as you can, even in the case of oil import, India is not abiding by US unilateral sanction as far as Russia is concerned. The same thing is happening in other areas. So, as of now, space exploration is one area where this sanction has not had no impact as of now. What will happen in future will be the course of war. And we would get to know it in months to come.
In addition to the impact of sanctions, India faces a challenge of physical damage to production facilities in Ukraine. Reports indicate that facilities storing hardware critical to Indian Space Research Organization may have suffered damage during the conflict. Furthermore, the reliance on Russia for astronaut training and access to the International Space Station adds another layer of complexity to India's space endeavors.
And now let's go to social media and see what people are to say about India's space exploration.
Sunay Gorkhade, citizen interested in technology. Chandrayaan 3rd is a historic mission that will pave the way for future Indian space exploration. I'm excited to see what new discoveries the mission will make. What are you most excited to learn from the Chandrayaan 3? SAR Foundation, an NGO educating children for economical weaker sections, tweeted, Yellow Room children witnessed the historic launch of ISRO 3rd lunar exploration mission. Chandrayaan 3 scheduled at 2:35 p.m. on Friday. India's commitment to space exploration elevates the dreams and ambitions of every Indian, especially children. Mona, a netizen whose bio says hate and division have no place in a healthy society, tweeted, India considers Russia a time-tested ally from the Cold War era with key cooperation in defense, oil, nuclear energy and space exploration. Luna Politics, a page where economics and politics intersect with the moon, tweeted, Russian analysts suggest BRICS countries cooperate on lunar and deep space exploration.
And that was our episode on Israel's arms sale threatening world peace and the US sanctions on Russia and its implications on India's growing space ambitions. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Lawyers for former President Donald Trump and prosecutors sparred in court on Tuesday, 18th of July, over when Trump's landmark criminal trial concerning the mishandling of classified documents should begin. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. United Press International has covered this story and tells us more. The timing for former President Donald Trump's classified documents trial is on hold, as the judge in Tuesday's pretrial hearing promised to issue a written order promptly. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon ended Tuesday's two-hour hearing in Fort Pierce, Florida, without setting a trial date, but signaled she would likely push the start date beyond mid-December, as proposed by federal prosecutors. Prosecutors and Donald Trump's legal team have sparred over the classified documents trial date, despite both requesting delays to the tentative August start. While prosecutors want the trial to start in December, Trump's lawyers argued for an indefinite delay, pushing the trial past the November 2024 presidential election. During Tuesday's hearing, Judge Eileen Cannon appeared skeptical of arguments that Donald Trump would not get a fair trial while running for president. Won't that just continue? Judge Eileen Cannon asked Trump attorney Christopher Keyes, when he referred to the intense publicity the case would attract before the election. Judge Cannon instructed Christopher Keyes to present other reasons, such as legal issues, for why the trial should not be expedited. Instead, District Judge Eileen Cannon focused on arguments relating to the large amount of discovery in the case, which she described as voluminous, and hinted that the trial could not start by the mid-December date proposed by the prosecutors. Lawyers for Donald Trump and his co-defendant, Walt Nota, asked the court last week to delay the case until after the 2024 presidential election, stating that beginning a case of this magnitude within 6 months of indictment is unreasonable, telling, and would result in a miscarriage of justice. Special Counsel Jack Smith last month had called for the case to be postponed from August to December, noting the sensitive nature of the classified materials in the case would require special considerations. Donald Trump's legal team requested a longer delay, citing several other ongoing cases involving the two men, the fact that Donald Trump and Walt Nota, his aide, would be on the campaign trail, and potential difficulties seating a jury in December as the campaign would be ramping up. Lawyers for Special Counsel Jack Smith, however, pushed back on the defense team's request, saying it borders on the frivolous. CBS News Miami has also covered this story and tells us more. Lawyers for former President Donald Trump and prosecutors sparred in court on Tuesday, 18th of July, over when his landmark criminal trial concerning the mishandling of classified documents should begin, but the judge put off an immediate decision. Judge Eileen Cannon said she would issue a written order after a nearly two-hour hearing in federal court in Fort Pierce, Florida, where lawyers for Donald Trump pressed for an indefinite delay of a trial date. Trump's lawyers say they need more time to prepare for what they describe as a complex case with a huge amount of evidence to review. They also argue that former president can't get a fair trial ahead of the 2024 election, in which he is seeking to reclaim the White House. They also noted he's preparing for three other trials as well. Prosecutors have proposed that the trial begins in December, saying the case is not complex and there's no need for a lengthy delay. Prosecutor David Habach told the judge that Donald Trump's legal team has repeatedly suggested he would be treated differently because he's running for president. "He should be treated like everyone else," David Habach said. Prosecutors revealed in court that they released 1.1 million pages of documents to the defense and said there are 1,545 classified documents, along with 1,186 days of closed-circuit television footage from Mar-a-Lago in Florida. It was the first time arguments were held in front of Judge Eileen Cannon in the unprecedented federal prosecution of the former president, who is also facing charges in a separate case in New York. Judge Cannon has been under increased scrutiny since a court ruling last year that critics said was unduly favorable to Donald Trump. Trump's co-defendant, Walt Nota, attended the hearing, but Donald Trump did not attend. He was traveling on Tuesday to Iowa, where he was taping a town hall with Fox News host Sean Hannity. The court date unfolded hours after Trump disclosed that he had received a target letter from the Justice Department in a separate investigation into efforts by him and his allies to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Such letters often precede an indictment. Donald Trump and Walt Nota have pleaded not guilty to a 38-count indictment that accuses them of conspiring to hide classified documents from Justice Department investigators that were taken from the White House to Mar-a-Lago at the end of Trump's time in office in January of 2021. CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story and tells us more. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon signals she is likely to push back the start of a trial in the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case beyond the mid-December date proposed by federal prosecutors, but appeared deeply skeptical of arguments from Donald Trump's lawyers that he couldn't get a fair trial while running for president. During the hearing in Fort Pierce, Florida, Judge Eileen Cannon told the prosecutors that their timeline was compressed and said that cases like this take more time. Judge Cannon did not decide on a trial date but said she plans to promptly issue an order on the matter. Special Counsel Jack Smith's team and lawyers for Donald Trump appeared on Tuesday for the first time in front of Judge Eileen Cannon, who will preside over the criminal case Jack Smith has brought against the former president. The judge also pressed the Trump legal team to commit to a timeline for at least some of the steps in the pretrial process. The defense attorneys told Judge Cannon that they believed they would be able to review enough discovery by November to be able to suggest a potential trial date. An attorney for Donald Trump claimed that the public viewed the special documents case as a top 2024 contender, and the administration of his chief political rival squaring off in the courtroom, prompting aggressive pushback from a lawyer for the special counsel. "The government says the claim is flat-out false," said prosecutor David Harbach, who pointed to the appointment of the special counsel and how that removed the potential for political influence. "There has been none," David Harbach said, "of political influence," noting that the current and former prosecutors on Jack Smith's team all served in career roles and that none of them were political appointees. "They're all here because the grand jury in this district returned an indictment of these defendants and they deserve a trial." David Harbach was responding to comments made by Donald Trump attorney Christopher Keyes, who was arguing that the 2024 presidential election and the publicity it would bring to the case would make it impossible to have a fair trial before the election. While Judge Eileen Cannon appeared receptive of defendants' claims that other aspects of the case may require an extensive pre-trial period, she did not seem persuaded by the argument that Donald Trump's status as a candidate meant that the trial would have to wait until after the 2024 presidential election.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is the short part of Imam Khomeini's speech. Imam Khomeini's opinion on hoping for the ultimate victory. Our victory will dawn when the hands of the foreigners are severed from our country and all the roots of monarchical regime are pulled out of our native land and all their forces are driven out. The foreign agents who have been making all these attempts and frenzied efforts recently to bring back the Shah, that is the former Shah, or install another regime, or safeguard the monarchy, and all such issues should realize that all this is now past history.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Karbala. In one of his speeches, he said that keep Karbala and the holy name of the leader or the master of the martyrs, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, alive, for their survival ensures the survival of Islam. Now, obviously, when we look at this part of his speech, it is something that was said by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Every Imam after Imam Hussein has emphasized on the same thing. And it shows that Imam Khomeini, strictly following the path of Ahlul Bayt, his sayings, his advices are based on the teachings of Ahlul Bayt. Once someone gets the knowledge from Ahlul Bayt and his teachings are based on the Ahlul Bayt, it remains alive. The struggle that they have, the struggle that they perform, it reaches to the success, because the success is because of the Ahlul Bayt. And when it is connected to the divine, Allah gives the victory to them. And in this part of speech, when he says that keep Karbala and the holy name of Imam Hussein, the master of the martyrs, alive, it means that Karbala has lessons to teach. When we keep the name of Karbala alive, it does not mean to just print the name of Karbala, to say Karbala. No, it means that talk about Karbala. Tell and inform people about what happened in the land of Karbala. What was the day of Ashura? Who was Imam Hussein alayhi salam? Why he got martyred? These things, all these things, when we talk about them, when we inform our generations, through this informing, they will be alive. And because of them, we will survive. You know that when we read the books of the history, there are some things that are written in the books, in the history. And every time we read them, obviously we are making them alive. They become alive because of this remembrance. And once we talk about them, later we can quote about it. Similarly, when we talk about Karbala, what happened in the Karbala, how the humanity was saved in the Karbala, how the modesty was saved in the Karbala, how the oppressors were failed in the Karbala, how the arrogant powers were failed in the Karbala, how justice won in the Karbala. When we talk about it, we can bring justice in this world.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In Britain, the RMT union has staged a second 24-hour strike in the past 3 days as ASLEF overtime ban nears its end. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Rail passengers across Britain are facing another day of limited and disrupted services as the RMT union stages a second 24-hour strike in 3 days in the long-running pay dispute with the government. Services started late on Saturday morning, 22nd of July, and ended early on Saturday night, with reduced schedules across England. In particular, as about 20,000 trained staff working for operators contracted to the Department of Transport took industrial action. The strike coincided with the last day of week-long overtime ban by train drivers in ASLEF, as well as engineering work, compounding the disruption and misery for travellers. Passengers forced into cars and coaches will have to contend with extremely busy roads, as gateway traffic from the start of the school holidays in England and Wales is expected to peak on Saturday, according to monitoring organisation forecasts. Most of the 14 affected train operators will be running roughly half their normal timetables, although there are wide variations in service levels. The strikes will also hit cross-border train services in Wales and Scotland, where staff are not directly in dispute with the government. Final departures on long-distance trains will come earlier in the afternoon, with Avanti West Coast running one train an hour between big cities. Engineering work on the main line linking London and Glasgow is affecting services. LNER, Cross Country and GWR will also cut their schedules. Others, including the Northern Line, Trans-Pennine Express, South Eastern, Govia Thames Link Railway and Chiltern, will stop services altogether on some lines and to many stations. Most major airport rail services will run through the daytime on one of the busiest weekends on flight departures from Britain, although reduced number of Southern and Thames Link trains will substitute with a suspended Gatwick Express from London. The Rail Delivery Group representing train operators said passengers should continue to check before travelling. Some disruption is likely to continue into Sunday morning, 23rd of July. A spokesman said the latest industrial action after a 24-hour strike on Thursday would affect not only the daily commute of our passengers, but family holiday plans and mean disappointment, frustration and financial strain for tens of thousands of people. The last in the series of the three 24-hour strikes planned by the RMT union comes next Saturday, 29th of July. Music and festival goers have been particularly affected by this wave of strikes, coinciding with a number of large events. The industry body Live said the strikes had put further pressure on a sector that had struggled through COVID pandemic and post-Brexit trooping constraints, with strikes affecting travel to music festivals including Latitude, Blue Dot and WOMAD. Union said the strikes have been forced by a lack of negotiation, with neither industry leaders nor ministers making them since they rejected a below-inflation pay offer earlier in the year. The Department for Transport has urged the unions to first allow members a direct vote on the deals on the table. A planned week of strikes on the London Underground was called off yesterday after talks between the unions and Transport for London reached a successful conclusion. Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Disruption to rail journeys is expected to intensify as a refusal to work overtime for 6 days this week has been extended, as a transport union boss vowed to strike for 20 years if necessary until a resolution is reached. ASDA announced last month that its members would withdraw non-contractual overtime, known as rest day working, with 16 of the country's 35 rail operators taking part. If confirmed, the industrial action will be mirrored later on in the month of July, coinciding with separate strike action scheduled by the RMT union. The train companies affected are Avanti West Coast, Chiltern Railways, Cross Country, East Midland Railways, Greater Anglia, GWR, GTR, Greater Northern Thames Link, Island Line, LNER, Northern Trains, South Eastern Railways, Southern Gatwick Express, South Western Railways Main Line, SWR Depot Drivers, TransPennine Express and West Midland Trains. Mick Whelan, ASNEF's General Secretary, told Sky News that he was prepared to take action for 2 decades until an agreement was reached with the government. "This can't go on forever. We want to resolve this no matter how badly the government treats us, no matter how badly they behave," he said. "It is still our intention to find a resolution. We're going to keep taking industrial action until someone listens to us." ASDEF's General Secretary Mick Whelan claimed he has been ignored by Transport Secretary Mark Harper and Rail Minister Hugh Merriman, who he said he hadn't spoken to for around 6 months. He told Sky News, "If we're whistling in the wind for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years to get somebody to table this, it will be resolved at some point and somebody will talk to us properly at some point." When asked if he was prepared to take industrial action for 2 decades, he replied, "Quite possibly, because the option is what to do? Nothing?" He hit out at the government for not being interested in the people, the workers of this country, and said, "It doesn't give a damn about key workers that put themselves at risk during the pandemic." Speaking earlier, ASDEF General Secretary Mick Whelan said there was no alternative but to take industrial action.
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, 3/4 of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. In the first part of the documentary, we took you on an investigative journey through Africa, China, Europe, and the U.S. in an effort to unravel the out-of-control corrupt systems enabling illegal e-waste recycling. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the US government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The US government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container. So it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers, and we take pictures of those, and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called TrackTrace, and here we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now it's in New Zealand.
Analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that till we started tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong Harbor is the third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? ₹63,000 containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbour. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sing, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
we can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck. And then if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbour every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one custom administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like United States, coming to Hong Kong.
He soon finds a storage yard. The e-waste shipments await transport over the border. And since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. The site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States so important work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in New Territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you'd pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste is crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guiyu.
When we went to the Guiyu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guiyu, but we just smell, very strong, the smell. Okay, we know, we arrived at Guiyu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. No. 80% of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of the yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guiyu, there is a division of labor.
Very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic and classify different types.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead, and mercury